This week on The Score, what did Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue say when he met with Virginia farmers? Is there a future for industrial hemp? Can farmers meet the challenges of today's agricultural sector? Will a crisis in pensions lead to economic failure? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Earlier this week, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue visited Roslyn Farm in Albemarle County at the invitation of 5th District Congressman Denver Riggleman. Perdue and Riggleman hosted a roundtable with about 24 farmers and agricultural business owners. The purpose was for the stakeholders in the agricultural sector to bring to Perdue's attention the problems and challenges they face. After the hour-long discussion with 5th District farmers, Secretary Perdue and Congressman Riggleman answered questions from the news media. The Score was there to record the whole conversation, and I was able to pose the first question, which I characterized as a softball, to get things going. Here's the Q&A with Sonny Perdue and Denver Riggleman.
I'll start with sort of a softball question, Mr. Secretary. There are a number of countries in the developing world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, that are trying to expand and modernize their agricultural sectors. What does USDA do to assist those countries?
Through USAID and through the USDA, we send technical help over. We send genetics over and work with typically the governmental ag agencies there, as well as growers and producers on the ground to do that. That's part of the humanitarian effort that the United States has done in many countries over the period of time. Congress appropriates a number of dollars for the McGovern Dole program, Food for Peace, and others, and emergency areas where we work with the World Food Program to feed children and school children across the world.
Anybody else?
Oh, go ahead. Yes, ma'am. What were some of the questions asked you today about,
Well, we had everything from USMCA to hemp farming to banking hemp, beef cattle, H-2A workers, and what the Secretary called the perverse wage rate rather than the adverse wage rate, trying to balance that for farmers, land use, everything you can think about for the 5th District because we're over 10,000 square miles. We're 65% rural. So it's just an honor that the Secretary would come down and help us with some of the issues that we have right now. So we had almost every type of farmer. I think many of them, from fruit pickers to tobacco to beef to dairy, you know, all of them were here today. And really it's about all those issues. And I think what we came up with is that we have a lot of work to do, but it's such a great job that the Secretary is doing right now. And getting the USMCA passes are a huge priority for us at this point.
This is the way representative government ought to work. The Congressman invited constituents representing different parts of agriculture. I'm in the executive branch, he's in the legislative branch, but working together makes for good public policy, along with the engagement of the public. That's where the real key is, to have people that are interested and leaders in their agricultural sector to come out and talk about the programs, the things that we're doing right, things that we're doing wrong, things that we're not doing, things we ought to be doing. And that's what's helpful here when we get out, and we do this a lot of times, but I appreciate Congressman Riggleman inviting me to the 5th District here in Southern Virginia where I can learn more about the issues right here on the ground.
And what we've started is an agriculture advisory committee, and the Secretary was so kind to actually kick it off for us. He's right about how we work together. We have representatives from Buckingham to Fauquier, all the way back down to Pennsylvania, out to Campbell. So We're just really fortunate that the Secretary would be here for our kickoff for Advisory Committee for Agriculture based on the size of our district.
And what are some of the biggest issues facing the Fifth District with agriculture?
First is getting the USMCA passed, but also its H-2A workers. It's not only how many can we get, but how do we pay the H-2A workers, what the wage rates are. But it's also the regulatory hurdles that many people face in any type of farming, you know, anything from hemp to tobacco. But it's really about what the regulations are, how the USDA is cutting back on those regulations, what they're doing, and how they're helping farmers. But it does come back to every single section of how the USDA actually works with other agencies to get things done for us. And it's also about information sharing. And the Secretary has some incredible ideas today about how we can do better information sharing between the federal sectors and the agricultural community so that we can get things done. And that's why we really appreciate him being here today.
Mr. Secretary, I was wondering if you had any remarks about what EPA said the other day on small refiner exemptions. They said there's zero evidence it's having a negative impact on corn ethanol producers. I know you've been really involved in this issue. Do you have any sort of response to that?
Well, certainly I would refute the this comment that has negative impact. They like to point to the export totals of ethanol production, which is good and healthy. We're trying to get more ethanol exports out there. But the demand destruction over domestic usage has been affected by the small refinery waivers. There's a $15 billion gallon RVO or volume obligation there. Every time you issue a waiver, you decrease that, which decreases corn use and decreases ethanol capacity for the American producer. And that's what we're debating right now. We had a good meeting Thursday in the Oval Office and are making some issues, some progress in recovering some of these small refinery waivers.
Is there any sort of, I know there are different ideas for have been floated for how to sort of address that short of EPA stopping the waivers?
I really think infrastructure growth is the key. The President, as you know, has authorized E15 year-round. What we've got to do is get pumps out there. What he's also authorized last week was the E10 pumps being certified for E15. If we can grow the E10 market, E15, and consumers should choose that because it's going to probably be 3 to 5 cents less per gallon. We think consumers will choose that. Higher octane and cleaner air. It makes sense to me that consumers would choose that. That's the potential to grow ethanol usage for 50% from 10 to 15 and certainly build up potentially 2 billion bushels of corn more utilization here domestically for energy production.
Mr. Secretary, the rising import taxes and retaliation by our trading partners has wreaked havoc on the agricultural sector in the United States. What can be done to recover? Can we reverse some of these really bad trade policies?
You know, a lot of times people in times like this when farming has been tough, a lot of people like to point to one single cause, and the tariffs are not the single cause of the economic duress on the farmers today. They've contributed, no doubt about it, but prices have been going down since 2012. And what we do need is more trade, and I think the President is committed to that. He's also committed to make sure that our trading partners play fair, play free, and reciprocal trade efforts. China has cheated for a long time, gotten away with it. President Trump is the first president that has had the courage to throw the flag and say, enough's enough, let's play by the rules. Any sports team out here has the same rules on both sides of the ball. And we need to get our trading partners to play by those rules. When we do, I'm convinced the United States producers, growers, farmers, ranchers will be able to compete anywhere in the world. It's not only China. It's the EU also has some very protectionist policies, and the President's dealing with those as well. That's why the USMCA agreement between Mexico and Canada, which helps to open up the dairy market in Canada, which had been closed, as well as dealing with other issues there, is so important. And that's why Congressman Riggleman is working to get USMCA passed in the House and the Senate.
Time for two more questions.
I think they're done.
Oh, no, there are more questions.
I saw your statement over the weekend on the initial deal with Japan, mm-hmm. and some of the reports have indicated that it's going to involve some corn purchases by Japan. Do you have any more information on that?
Well, we know more details. USDA is releasing those, I think, and working with other countries. We don't want to get ahead of them, and and spring some news they're not prepared to release yet. So more information, detailed information will be coming out. Frankly, it's good for agriculture. We didn't get everything we want, but that's the way trade negotiations do. Rice, which is not too big here in Virginia, is probably not going to be fare very well. That's unfortunate in Arkansas and Louisiana and those areas. But obviously beef and wheat and other crops such as corn that you mentioned will do very well.
There was a number of questions in the roundtable about hemp. And Congressman Riegelman, you're on the Financial Services Committee. What can you do from that seat to help with the banking of people who are growing hemp?
Make it easier, you know, allow the states to bank hemp without a pretty much regulation that can hinder them at the local, state, and federal level. And what we talked about during this time was it's not just the federal level that we have to worry about on the regulatory side, but it's the state and local level. So for hemp banking, you know, there's acts already out there in the Financial Services Committee to allow that banking specifically for hemp. I'm working very closely with Andy Barr from Kentucky also on the hemp banking issue to ensure that there's a streamlined methodology for doing that. We just want to make sure that all bankers, right, don't feel like they're going to, you know, have some kind of issue banking something that's been legalized. And that's what I talked, you know, with the Secretary about, is we just want to ensure that that happens. But we're going to work pretty hard. I'd like to be the first congressman to grow hemp in the country, so I'm going to talk to somebody about that, and I'd like to do it. I got the property to do it. So if I can do that, I think that would be pretty special to get hemp on our property, and I think that's what we're going to try to do.
My wife and I took advantage of this weekend to come down early. We've enjoyed the hospitality in Charlottesville. The history and the hospitality are amazing, so we want to thank everyone here in the area for accommodating.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
One of the participants at Roslyn Farm was Virginia's Secretary of Agriculture and Forestry, Bettina Ring. After the press conference with Congressman Riegelman and Secretary Perdue, I pulled her aside to ask a few questions about the agriculture sector in Virginia. I started by asking about the challenges faced by Virginia farmers, and then we talked about some of the innovations that will help the farm business grow and prosper in the future.
Just a few quick questions about agriculture in Virginia. What are the biggest challenges facing Virginia farmers and agribusiness in general?
Certainly, there are a lot of things that are outside of our control, such as trade. There are a lot of uncertainties right now with some of our largest trading partners, China, Mexico, Canada. Hopefully we'll soon have an agreement signed with Canada and Mexico. We want to make sure that we continue to keep those markets open for our farmers and producers because we do export quite a bit. We have close to 50% of the containers going out of the Port of Virginia that are exports, and so that is truly important. We always have the weather and things that are outside of our control in the ag industry. We also have some hope for the future with hemp being a new product for us. We now have 10,000 acres of hemp being grown in the state. Last year we had 135, so thanks to the Farm Bill and also some legislation passed at the state level, it's allowed us to move forward in a more assertive way, and so we're excited about that. We know there are challenges for the dairy industry right now, and that's something we're trying to work on, to have more value-added processing in the state so that we can keep our dairy industry alive.
You mentioned hemp, and I wanted to ask about that because it's a rather new crop. Virginia is historically a tobacco state, but the use of tobacco is declining precipitously. Mm-hmm. Is hemp a good replacement for tobacco on all of those acres in Southside Virginia?
It absolutely is. And so it's a nice alternative crop in Southern Virginia as well as Southwest Virginia. So the areas that have been strong tobacco regions for us, now this is an opportunity to have an alternative crop because even with the tobacco that's still being grown, we were seeing a decline there in purchasing. So it's something that we are really excited about. We want to continue to make sure we're moving forward with a strong program. And so working with the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, we have close to 1,000 producers that have registered and about 160 processors in the state. And so we think it's going to be a robust industry. And it takes us back to our early days and hemp was being grown in the state. Here we are celebrating our 400th anniversary in the state and the beginning of the country. So it's much to be hopeful about.
Well, proponents of hemp farming seem to consider it to be some kind of miracle fiber. What kind of uses will Virginia industries get out of the hemp that's being grown?
Right. I think it is important for us to look at the diversity of what the products you can have through hemp. So certainly CBD oil is one that's more lucrative, and many of our farmers are very excited about that, as well as companies that are getting involved in investing. But there's also textiles. There's many fiber products that, from clothing to the interior of automobiles and housing. And so we want to make sure that we have a diverse industry here in the state so that we can weather the storms, no pun intended, that come before us, and we believe we can build that industry.
Just to wrap up, what are some other innovations in the agriculture industry and the agriculture sector that will propel Virginia forward for the next 30 or 40 years?
Right. Well, technology is big. You can see precision agriculture, we're able to be more productive, to be more efficient, and so that can be more cost-effective for our farmers, our producers. Technology is going to play a big role moving forward for farmers as well as forest landowners in the state. Rural broadband's an issue, so we want to make sure that if we can have high-speed internet across the state, we know we can grow agriculture by 18% in the state, and so we're hopeful that we're going to be able to take the state money that we have with the federal dollars that we're securing, and also the cooperatives that are stepping up to lead on this issue with the private sector to move things forward to address that issue. We also are excited because we have a great incentive program in the state to make sure that there are businesses that don't fall through the cracks. This was developed in 2012, and just since our administration has been in 2018, we've announced 28 projects, and this is allowing us to support agriculture and forest industries, either businesses coming to Virginia or businesses wanting to expand that already exist here. And so we have great examples out there, a dairy farm in Dinwiddie County, Richlands Dairy. The daughter went away to college, came back home, helped her family turn their business model around. We were able to fund and support a local creamery there. They're selling ice cream and their milk products there. They're going to open a restaurant eventually. So we see the requirements of this program really ask that you source at least 30% of your product locally. Some are sourcing 100% of their product locally. So it's good for the farmers, it's good for forest landowners, it's good for the industry, and good for our economy. Another thing we're very excited about is the fact that we're back to being number one for business in the state. So recently, Governor Northam announced that CNBC really moved us back into that ranking of number one, and I think that's because of a number of factors, certainly workforce development and the emphasis we're placing on that, as well as our higher education institutions. We have wonderful institutions across the state, as well as the community college system, working hand-in-hand with four-year universities to really make sure we're providing the future workforce, and that we're providing more technical skills as well, because that is an issue across the state. But we are very hopeful that we're going to be able to recruit more businesses that want to work, live, and play here in Virginia. It's a great place to live.
Just a final follow-up. We're here today with Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue. How are the relations or cooperation between the federal USDA and the Virginia Department of Agriculture? How do you work together? Where do you find yourselves falling apart?
Right. We work very closely with them, the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, as well as the Department of Forestry, working with USDA, because they include all the programs, the funding that comes to the states to help us deliver programs, the requirements that we may have related to food safety. So we work hand-in-hand with them to make sure we're doing all we can to remove barriers for farmers and producers and forest landowners, and to make sure that we're keeping consumers safe and that we're protecting them at the same time. There's certainly challenges around trade right now, and that's something that we try to maintain communications. In fact, next week I'm going on a USDA trade mission to Canada. Mm-hmm. I'll be working with USDA Undersecretary McKinney there, who's doing a lot to try to advance markets in other countries, especially as we, for Virginia, looking at the fact that China, things are changing in China. We want to make sure that we're looking at other markets abroad. And so being able to participate in these USDA trade missions allows us to take Virginia businesses along for them to be able to meet with buyers and to be able to hopefully sell more product and learn more about those markets and deepen those relationships. So we work with USDA, with Secretary Perdue and the staff across the board to make sure we're bringing issues forward that are impacting our farmers and our industry and our forest landowners, but also that we're trying to work in a collaborative way to do all that we can to advance agriculture in the state and in the U.S.
Well, thank you, Secretary Ring. I appreciate your comments today. Thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may have noticed that Secretary Perdue, Congressman Riggleman, and Secretary Ring all talked about hemp. Growing hemp in the United States was illegal for a long time, but under the most recent federal farm bill, it became legal across the country. During the 2018 Virginia Festival of the Book, I had a chance to interview author Doug Fine about his then-recent book, Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution, in which he expresses his enthusiasm for the many uses of industrial hemp. From the archives, here's Doug Fine. I spoke to him in Charlottesville in March 2018.
Doug Fine, you're a prolific author on many topics, but you're here to talk about hemp today. What are the economic advantages of growing industrial hemp?
Well, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, but even with the limited federal research legalization, the industry is growing by double digits, and it's providing farmers who cultivate it successfully and are willing to be in it for the long haul with significantly better returns than sort of the big three of corn, wheat, soy.
What can you make from hemp?
Boy, there's so, well, I'll just describe the low-hanging fruit. There's three parts of the plant: the flowering part, the seed, and the fiber. The seed is a superfood. The fiber goes into things like hemp building materials, animal bedding, and next generation, battery components and supercapacitors. And the flower has cannabinoids in it, components of the plant, though what we call hemp today doesn't have significant amounts of the psychoactive component THC. It has components of other components of the plant, such as CBD, which are showing really good sort of health maintenance and other benefits, and that's a big market today.
Now, if I recall my history correctly, in the 18th and 19th centuries, the government mandated that farmers grow hemp, but then it became illegal. What happened? How did that change come about?
I look at it as just a weird little blip due to a weird little policy at a specific time in history, because this is one of humanity's, hemp cannabis is one of humanity's longest utilized plants. And so for it, or any plant, to be not allowed to be cultivated is, it's ludicrous. And so we had 77 years of cannabis prohibition that, when you factor it on 10 to 12,000 years of human cultivation, will just be looked at as a weird blink. As for what actually caused it, it was a combination of factors. The hemp industry was actually, at the time of cannabis prohibition started in 1937, it was undergoing a temporary dip. It was actually poised for resurgence when the Marijuana Tax Act started. We could get into a whole lot of explanations, some with more and less conspiracies attached to them, but the bottom line is it was such a bad policy right from the start that when World War II started in the Philippines and the other sources of hemp that the Navy desperately needed for rigging ropes, George H.W. Bush's parachute cord that saved his life was made from hemp. Quickly, the Department of Ag had to make a pro-hemp propaganda film called Hemp for Victory, which folks can find on YouTube, and immediately hemp prohibition ended during World War II. Then it restarted again, unfortunately, for another 50 years for terrible political reasons, but thankfully we're almost through with it today.
You travel a lot around the country, around the world. Where in the United States is hemp cultivation succeeding the best?
They're succeeding the best in the states where at the very top, ideally at the governorship level, the executive level, but also when you have top ag people supporting it in the agriculture departments with farmer support, that's where it's coming out of the gate strongest, making full use of the federal laws as they exist today. So the states that are really leading the charge include Colorado, Kentucky, Oregon, New York, both North and South Carolina look like they have good programs, and more states are coming on with good programs. Wisconsin and California both look like they'll be pretty good.
And how do these states differ from each other? Are they encouraging different uses for the hemp, or are they all sort of going in the same direction?
It's a good question. So what it comes down to, again, this is why I say it's so important to have the will at the top. What it comes down to is because there has been such a large amount of taxpayer money, billions every year, for the drug war infrastructure, it's an economy of itself. And bureaucrats' jobs are to keep their jobs and to keep their people under the, you know, them employed. And that's legitimate. I'm a believer in our system. But this is beyond bureaucracies operating on autopilot. This is too important to America's economic future. This is too important to our rural economy, to our soil building, to environmental climate change mitigation. So it's a moral thing to end this drug war. But bureaucrats tend not to think that way and are reluctant to let go of pots of money that they've had for a long time, 40 years or more. So the bureaucrats are, in many cases, is for some of the enforcement agencies are fighting to keep their turf and continue fighting the drug war when it is the will of the people and the will of Congress to have it ended. So, long story short, any part of current hemp legislation that is construed to not be explicit, some federal agencies are fighting, and the states that are succeeding are saying no. The law, federal law, is saying, for instance, you can move hemp genetics between Farm Bill compliant hemp cultivators from one state to another, or you can cultivate all parts of the plant, including the flower part of the plant. Other states are hearing from their local federal agencies, no, we don't like this, and they're kind of looking backwards rather than it's a question of whether or not the state policy is looking forwards to the promise of the plant or is a little bit worried and looking back to the just say no era, which is the wrong side of history.
Where are we going to be in 10 years?
Hemp will be generating more than $1 billion a year in revenue for North American farmers. It will still be a niche industry compared to the acreage that other crops cultivate, but it will continue what is already its double-digit annual growth curve.
Great. Well, thanks for your time today. I appreciate your participating in this panel, and thank you for joining us on The Score, Bering Drift Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Great.
Anyone who plans to live past retirement age has thought about how they will pay their bills in the future when they are no longer working. Many people will rely solely on Social Security. Others have pension plans provided through their employers. Many of these pension plans are on weak ground, according to our next guest. Jen Sidorova is a New York-based policy analyst for the Reason Foundation, and her research on the state of pensions in the United States offers cause for concern. I spoke to Jen by telephone on Thursday.
What is the major challenge to the pension system that we're facing today?
Right. So most of the public pension plans, and those are the kind of plans that my team works on, are defined benefit plans. And there are some defined benefit type of plans in the industry as well. So with defined benefit plans, you are guaranteeing the employee a certain amount of income upon retirement. And this retirement income comes from investment returns and from the employer and employee contributions. So basically, both employer and employee set aside a little bit of money, and over time, this money brings up investment returns, and then once the worker retires, they kind of paid out their retirement benefit checks out of that pool of money. So inherently, those type of pension plans are tied to investment returns. And in today's economy, we see that it's sort of a new normal, but investment returns are lower. And for the next 30 years, they're likely to be lower than they were 30 years ago. And even though right now we're kind of at the peak of investment returns, at the peak of the market, we still see that our pension plans are underfunded. And that means that there's not enough money in the pension plans across the nation in both public and private pension plans. There's just not enough money saved up to pay out all the benefits that are guaranteed in the future. And that's a problem because, again, this is the peak of the market, and really at the peak of the market, pension plans should be fully funded. We might see a little bit of a dip in a recession time, but right now they really should be really fully funded.
Are the pension plans underfunded because of poor planning or because of changes in the economy that couldn't be foreseen or because they've overpromised in terms of what the guaranteed benefit will be?
It's a little bit of both. So as I said, investment returns do play a big role in that. But this is something that can be foreseen using, you know, market forecasting, using advice of consulting firms. But what we see right now, in particular with public pension plans, is that pension boards are kind of, they cannot accept this new reality, and they kind of have this wishful thinking. They wish the future was different, and they have this investment return that is currently 7%, although, you know, by all predictions, they really should be expecting more than about 5%, maybe 6% in some cases. But they based all of their decisions based on this over-optimistic investment return that we know is not going to happen. And that messes up the whole system. That's they cannot properly calculate the contributions they need to make, and they are not really expecting the right amount of the money to go into the system, and that that basically is the definition that they're not being really properly, really very well managed. So yes, it's both the investment, the low investment returns because of the structural changes in the economy that happened over the past 10 to 15 years, and it's also lack management of the realistic predictions of the realistic investment returns. As far as the overpromising, that's really individual to each individual plan. Some of those plans that we see do not have, you know, their benefits are not even that generous. And for that, for others, it's a little bit different. Some of them do have some practices that, you know, kind of inflate this benefit a little bit, but that's individual.
How many people are we talking about who will be affected by this? How many? A better question, I think, is how many people in the aging population getting ready to retire are going to rely entirely on Social Security, and how many, perhaps, you know, a percentage basis, how many will be relying on Social Security plus a pension plan from their work careers?
Right. So there are about 10 million full-time, about 3 million part-time local government civilian employees right now. And, I mean, that number is kind of an approximate. And so most of those people are on the pension plans that I'm talking about, the public pension plans. And at this point, they still have time. I can't really say that they will be reliant on Social Security. That's definitely the danger of it if the whole system collapses. But right now, we kind of at this point where we can still make changes. And this is important exactly for this reason, because if there are not changes made to those public, both public and private pension systems, and ultimately all those public sector employees, a lot of them are teachers as well, the teachers and government workers, they're all going to be reliant on Social Security. That will be an issue. And right now, they were still kind of in the corridor when changes can be made. And there were some examples of such changes. For example, in Arizona, Michigan, Colorado, Pennsylvania, those are all examples of bipartisan changes into their defined benefit systems that will eventually put them on the right track. And those changes will take a lot of time. They will take 30 years for them to get to become fully funded, but eventually they are going to be on solid foot. And I guess the main danger is, again, if those plans are not properly managed, they go into Social Security, which is the most expensive way of funding the benefits, because you're missing out on this investment return. As I said in the beginning, the defined benefit plans are based on this assumption that you're going to get a bunch of money, you're going to invest it, and then money is going to make more money. With Social Security, there's no money that's making money. You're just spending it all right out of the way. All the money is just getting consumed. And that's the issue that we're facing. And this is a good time. Right now is a better time to solve this. It's going to be cheaper to solve the issue of pensions right now at the peak of the returns than it will be in the recession. It will cost a lot more if we start solving this once the recession hits.
You mentioned a few states. I wonder if you could point to a state that you think is doing the right thing right now, and that it, you know, that it should be used as a model. And if you could also point to a state where their pension systems are in such disarray that, that they are the model for what not to do. I guess I'm asking for a best case and a worst case scenario.
Right. So I think a good example of a good recent reform would be Michigan. And they did a few things there. Very importantly, they're paying off their debt more responsibly now. They're also properly funding the plan right off the bat, meaning that, you know, all of their contributions are in order, and everything is arranged in a way that they're not likely to build as much more new debt. And they also opened up something. They also did something else. They opened up a choice plan, meaning that the new workers do not have to get the defined benefit plan. They can also opt out for a defined contribution plan, which is it's sort of similar. I mean, it's a retirement plan that's, again, you invest a bunch of money and it's making new money and you gain investment returns. But then the government is no longer responsible for that. It's it's all the risk lies on the employee. So that's a little bit, that's kind of a risk shift from employer to the employee. But that opens up a little bit more opportunities for the employee, because as opposed to defined benefit plans, with defined contribution plans, you can take that money out of the system and you can transfer it to kind of a new employer. So you can take that, you know, that retirement plan is staying with you, whereas with defined benefit plans, that you cannot transfer it across employees. So if you were to find a new job in a different state, with defined benefit plan, you can't do it, but with defined contribution plan, you can just transfer your retirement savings. So that's an example of a good reform. That's Michigan. I think for the parents that are in trouble, I would say it's Kentucky, Illinois, and Connecticut. Those are all kind of different situations. But I would say that there are commonalities, not only between these three, but also all the plans that are in trouble. I would say some of them have never pre-funded their plan. That was the case with Connecticut, and that's never a good idea, because you're just not, you're basically setting yourself for failure in the first place if you're not pre-funding the plan. And others had other, you know, subpar practices, like not paying their actuarially determined contribution. That's the amount of the contribution that you have to pay that actuaries actually tell you to pay. And they really have to do that, and not some of the plans have failed to do that, because ultimately it ended up being a political decision for them. So that was, I guess, another very common failure for public pension plans. And again, others just have consistently failed to predict how much money they're going to get in by either, you know, just expecting too much, too high of an investment return, or expecting salaries to grow, or they didn't properly calculate, you know, their membership, how many people are they going to have reliant on their retirement, on their pension plan at the end of the day, and all sorts of things. Just, it's very important for a defined benefit plan to keep track of what's going on in the plan, and constantly having experience studies that tell you, you know, what is that you're having, what is going on in your plan, and what is that you can expect in the future. Yeah, I think just having a very transparent system where there's a lot of dialogue and a lot of feedback between independent actuary and the pension plan, and the pension plan is willing to do what is being advised by professionals, is generally a good practice to do. And yeah, there are plans like you know, New York State and North Carolina. New York State, but not New York City. I'm just mentioning it because that's where I'm from. And so New York State and North Carolina, they're well-funded plans, and they were always defined benefit plans. And they managed to keep their systems almost fully funded. So it's not the problem of defined benefit plan system. It's really just how the particular pension board, particular state is managing it.
Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but Jen Sidorova, thank you for joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. I think this issue of pensions is one that's going to affect a lot of our listeners in the years to come, and I appreciate your thoughts today.
Thank you so much.
To close out this week's episode of the Score, we return to the topic of hemp, industrial hemp, hemp farming, banking for hemp growers, which was addressed briefly in our first half hour by Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and Congressman Denver Riggleman. For a deeper dive, I turned to Jacob Rich of the Reason Foundation, who was a guest on the Score a few months ago talking about policy aimed at stemming the nationwide opioid crisis. I asked Jacob to provide some basic information about hemp, including its legal status as well as its uses. We spoke by telephone on Thursday, and sometimes our connection was less than perfect. Listen closely, however, and you'll learn as much as I did from our conversation.
Today we want to talk about hemp, industrial hemp, which maybe you can give us some background on this, because for a long time it was illegal for farmers in the United States to grow hemp, but a recent piece of legislation changed that. Can you explain what's happened?
Yes. So basically, the incredibly restrictions on Schedule I substances was inherited
male and female version. And the female version is what people tend to use to get high because it has a high level of what is called THC, and that drug is basically to get high. But the male version basically has such low amounts of THC that you can't get high from it. But because of the way that we schedule the substance in the United States, we were actually not allowed to grow hemp, the male marijuana version, until the most recent farm bill passed. After that bill passed, basically any sort of production with hemp is allowed if you're allowed it through a pilot program. Basically, the federal government says that it's decriminalized for all intents and purposes on their end, and they're encouraging states to go out and allow this growing of hemp because it's actually an incredible industrial product. It can make rope, it can make paper, it's then touted to possibly make plastics that are even stronger than the plastics that we make out of fossil fuels. It's supposed to be able to supplement concrete, make that extra strong. So there's a lot of experimentation just to use the hemp and various other industrial types of pursuits. However, there are some consumable byproducts in hemp that aren't THC. So what this farm bill did is that it reclassified marijuana is the Controlled Substances Act, which is what made marijuana Schedule 1 and made restrictions around it so strict, for lack of better terms. So basically, any sort of marijuana variant that has less than 0.3% THC in it, for all intents and purposes, is going to be considered classified as CSA. So if you're growing any sort of product or have a product, as long as it has less than 0.3% THC, it is now legal. And it's incredibly funny what this has brought on, because there's actually a lot of medical applications for hemp or substances that can be derived from hemp. So even though THC is still legal, a lot of derivatives of hemp have been basically extracted and have entered the legal market, which was not really seen by many legislators. And one of these ingredients is CBD. And CBD has actually been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat epilepsy in the form of Epidiolex, the first marijuana-derived medication to actually get FDA approval. But now, since there's basically no regulation from the federal level on hemp, all of these cannabinoids are being extracted. They're actually entering the supplement market, so people are kind of freaking out at the moment about all these potential cannabinoids and possible abuse of these extractions from CBD. But there's really not too much to worry about, and I think that's a pretty good foundation. Is there anything specific you'd like me to discuss among all that?
Well, I'd like to find out who was the... Or what was the impetus behind the farm bill making hemp growing legal? Who were the people lobbying for this change in the law?
Well, I don't quite know as much about this as you might hope, but I do know the market mechanisms that might have motivated it. You see, hemp before the farm bill passed was actually illegal. Was actually legal to possess in the United States. It was just illegal to grow. So basically, there's actually a bunch of hemp that's been in this country for a while. It's just been grown in other countries such as China and places that have less strict control over their international trees. So basically, all the drug laws that are implemented in the United States are some sort of derivative of international treaties of drug laws. And we actually are much more strict than other countries on many of our regulations. But the treaties actually allow countries to grow hemp if they want. And we were basically importing all of our hemp products. And I think there's probably just been a lot of momentum to start using CBD and all sorts of applications. And companies in the United States felt really disadvantaged, especially the farmers, that they couldn't grow it here legal. So I think this was really just to allow our farmers to increase their competitive advantage against other farmers in other countries. And to allow the production of hemp, which we actually have great plans for, to actually start happening here so we can enter that market, since hemp is being used more and more for all sorts of different types of applications.
I'm speaking to you from Virginia, which for 400 years has been a leading tobacco grower in the United States. It was one of the first places tobacco was grown for export to Europe. But the demand for tobacco has declined precipitously over the past couple of decades. Is hemp a good substitute that people who've been growing tobacco could grow instead as a commercial product?
It's even better than tobacco, because hemp and marijuana in general, well, cannabis in general, so marijuana refers to the female weed, and then hemp basically refers to any of the byproducts, or basically any of the parts of the plant in the male version. And hemp is an incredible thing to grow, because all cannabis, when it is grown in the field, is actually a turn crop, and it actually puts nutrients back into the soil, so it's an incredible tool to use for farmers who aren't even focusing on hemp. So maybe they could grow some corn, then grow some hemp, and then maybe grow whatever else they want to grow, and then grow hemp again. It actually helps keep their soil much more healthy. And I, you know, amid all that, it seems like the implementation of hemp in to replace tobacco would definitely be welcome. The only problem is that tobacco is an incredibly regulated market. They probably get inflated prices for their tobacco when they sell it. And you're probably going to have to sell a lot more hemp to equal the amount of money you're going to get from tobacco. But, you know, without those regulations, you should be able to at least have the flexibility to innovate to grow more. And it's actually much easier to grow more hemp than to grow more tobacco anyway. So there's disadvantages and advantages, and they aren't going to have to increase the supply of crop they produce in order to meet the revenue that they had before. But that seems something reasonable. I think it's a great replacement.
Earlier this week, I was at an event with Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and our local congressman Denver Riggleman, where they brought together a bunch of stakeholders, mostly farmers, to talk about agriculture issues. And one question that came up from some of the farmers who have begun to grow hemp was that they are having trouble getting loans from banks or being able to work with banks who are a bit wary of lending money or accepting deposits from people who are growing hemp, which until recently has been an illegal product. Are you aware of anything that's being done within the banking industry to address this problem, to inform bankers that it's okay to grow hemp and it's not the same as growing marijuana for recreational use?
I know of nothing happening at the legislative level because, like you just said, it is now completely legal for them to give loans. They basically should be giving these loans as easily if they were going to give loans for corn. It's just that these companies are going to have to evaluate themselves whether they want to move into giving loans. These banks have to consider the risk that they might be inheriting if they start giving loans for hemp, because there is a possibility, because hemp is so similar to marijuana, there might be some foul play before we inevitably do legalize marijuana as well. And there might be some marijuana growing in these pet facilities. And if the bank is caught giving loans that eventually went to the production of a Schedule One substance, they're probably okay as long as they were reasonably, if they took enough care to know the risk their negligence in that situation saved them. But it is their court to basically say that. And if they are accused of supplying for a Schedule One product, they could have their charters taken away. These massive corporations really do not want to even flirt with the idea of that happening to them. So it's really just them taking extra precaution before moving into the space, because they don't want to have any sort of association with funding illegal drugs, because that's one of the biggest violations that they can have in terms of the banking regulations.
And, of course, in the states where recreational and medicinal marijuana are legal, this banking problem affects that industry as well, which is separate from the industrial hemp industry. Is there anything being done to address that problem?
Yes. And there's a lot of opinions on this, because the interpretation of the Constitution and all the legislation that gets forward is actually quite unique among a lot of people. Right now I'm writing a paper at Reason, basically discussing the scheduling system, one thing that I mentioned in this paper is that if President Trump wanted to legalize marijuana tomorrow, he really could. He could just go up to Alexander Azar and AG William Barr and say, hey guys, let's reschedule marijuana and legalize it. And the entire scheduling apparatus is actually within the executive branch, so they didn't even need Congress to do that, which is one interesting fact that when I was talking to some officials, they didn't know that. And in terms of the banking regulation, there's a lot of legislation that's been put forward, and sometimes people say, oh, this doesn't address the banking issue because it doesn't mention banking specifically. I actually disagree, because the banking issue is all about what is deemed to be illegal by the federal government. And if legislation says something is no longer illegal, then you are completely fine. So one act that's been proposed is the States Act. The States Act basically says the federal government no longer is going to criminalize marijuana. We're only going to enforce what the states say is legal and not legal. And if a state like Colorado, which has legalized it, says that, hey, we want this activity to happen within our state, according to the language in the States Act, any activity to legalize marijuana that the state of Colorado has approved is now legal by federal standards. However, if a state makes no decision on what to do with marijuana, until they do so, it's still treated as a Schedule I product. So there's a lot of complications that could come from this, but I think it's actually kind of simple. So if you have a state that's next to Colorado, and they legalize marijuana, then transporting marijuana across the state borders then becomes legal. At the moment, transporting marijuana across state borders is a felony. And it has I think it actually has quite a high minimum sentence, but I'm not exactly sure what it is. But yeah, it's an incredible penalty for transporting marijuana. But after the state act would be passed, if two states say it's okay to transport marijuana across the state, then you're fine. Basically, anything that happens within the state's fine, and then banks should be able to treat each state individually that is doing marijuana. Now, they might be hesitant to jump on this automatically because they are operating in Colorado, and then some of their money gets funneled into a state that has not legalized marijuana, such as Mississippi, then they might be held liable for funding an operation, and then they're going to have to show whether they were negligent or whether they took enough care given the risk of money going to where it should not be. So the same thing could happen from the States Act, but there actually has been marijuana banking legislation that's been proposed by in Congress as well. And if this passed, then it basically just legalized banks to give money to marijuana companies in general across the board. So there is very specific things that come forward. The State Act is probably my favorite, short of just rescheduling marijuana for it to be legal.
Just to wrap up, earlier in our conversation, you were talking about the various uses that industrial hemp has. As you were doing your research, did you find any particular application for hemp that really surprised you and makes you think, hey, this is something we really should pursue?
Industrially, I've been pretty familiar with what's been going on in the space for a while, so nothing really surprised me there. Like, rubbers and stuff are kind of cool, but what I think the most interesting thing that hemp has been shown to do, and CBD that's derived from the marijuana plant as well, has been shown to do this as well. But basically, the Food and Drug Administration legalizing Epidiolex because clinical trials show that children who take CBD who have severe seizures, when they are exposed to THC, it's one of the most effective compounds to basically alleviate seizure symptoms in people with epilepsy. And you know, epilepsy of children is a terrible disease. You know, very few children are born with it, but the ones who do, their life is often hell. And CBD is an incredible product. The Brookings Institution did a giant documentary about a girl's life who has changed, and they actually talked about the current side effects of previously used epilepsy drugs. And they would have terrible side effects such as anxiety and suicidal thoughts. And CBD seems to almost not affect the mental state of the people who take it at all. It just seems to be a complete relief of their seizures. So the fact that such a beautiful product came out of CBD is incredible. And I'm very excited for the future medical applications of the drug as well.
Wow. Well, that's a good point to end on. Jacob Rich of the Reason Foundation, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate your time today, and I hope we have a chance to talk again sometime soon.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Next week, we'll be back with more news, reviews, and interviews, including some conversations with politicians at the annual Buena Vista Labor Day Parade. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us and join in on the fun on BearingDrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.